From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. You may never have heard of Huey Moe, but you've probably heard his records. Moe produced hits for Archie Bell and the Drells, the Sir Douglas Quintet, Jerry Lee Lewis, and dozens of other performers. Coming up, we hear how he earned the nickname the Crazy Cajun. Also today, thrill-crazy teens and the sin-steeped story of today's beat generation. Michael Barson tells us about his book of posters advertising the great trash films of the 50s. TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new live version of Not Necessarily the News, and rock and roll historian Ed Ward tells the story of the Memphis label High Records. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. His nickname is the Crazy Cajun. He's also been called the godfather of Gulf Coast rock and roll. Huey P. Moe is a Houston-based record producer who's had a lot of hits, combining the blues, country, Cajun, and rock and roll sounds of his birthplace, Louisiana, and his home, Texas. He discovered, then produced hits for Doug Somm's group, the Sir Douglas Quintet, Freddie Fender, Archie Bell and the Drells, and Rockin' Sidney. He's also produced records by Jerry Lee Lewis, T-Bone Walker, and Clifton Chenier. Huey P. Moe was born during the Great Depression. His family was poor. His father couldn't read or write. Moe got his start in music, performing at house parties with his father's Cajun band. Moe says he was too hot-tempered to hold down a job, so he went to barber school and opened up his own shop. But he couldn't keep out of music. He didn't think he was much of a musician or singer, but he loved working in the recording studio. This was Moe's first big hit, Barbara Lynn singing You'll Lose a Good Thing. It rose to number 8 on the charts in 1962.
If you should lose me, oh yeah, you lose a good thing. If you should to you, 'cause if you should lose me, oh yeah, you lose a good thing.
When you recorded that record, You Lose a Good Thing, you were still working in a barbershop in Texas.
Yes, in Winnie, Texas, southeast Texas, where it is, by Beaumont, Port Arthur. It's called the Golden Triangle. It's home of the Big Bopper.
Now, how did you first hear Barbara Lynn? Would you tell us the story behind that?
I was working in the barbershop, and a guy brought me a tape, and he wanted me to hear somebody called T-Baby Green, which was a blues, real blues, down-home blues act. And in between, he was knocking me out, but in between the tapes, it recorded, I had a little Walden sack in them there, and it was recorded on there, and I could hear this girl singing in between. Somebody had recorded over her. And she was just knocking me out, and I said, man, just, you know, I'd give anything to work with that voice. You look at the voice and the song, if you can marry them together, that's the secret to it. And so that one day a guy by the name of James Young, Big Sambo Young, he passed away last year, he come in there and I asked him, I said, James, who's this girl singing right here? He said, oh, he said, it's Barbara Lynn. He said, you want her? I said, yeah, I'd like to have her. And so he'd come back down there by 6:30 at night, they were just closing up, and he had Barbara with him. Played a left-handed blues guitar and just sang her butt off. It was just too much, man.
You said the main thing is to match the right voice with the right song. Did you pick the song for her to sing?
She had sent me a tape after this thing that had 5 songs on it. You Lose a Good Thing was among 5 songs, and I said, that's a hit. And I didn't have the money. I had to get her to I paid the band in New Orleans in the studio, and I bought some Sid Roebuck tape, and I asked if she could make it to New Orleans where I'd record the song, because I thought it was great.
Well, you didn't have the money, but that song ended up making you a lot of money. It was a big hit in 1962.
It still does. Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, you had Freddie Fender re-record that.
Yeah,
because
I've always re-recorded. Songs of Timeless, the great songs of love and the sentimental heart affairs, always timeless. They live forever.
So when you made a lot of money from that song, did you get out of the barbershop?
This was my first check. It was real weird. I got a check because we was very poor. My daddy couldn't read and write even when he died a few years ago. We were very poor, and I had a check from my friend here, Harold Lips, is here in town, for $48,000. And we had never, none of my family all put together, had never seen that kind of money. And I put it in the little bank in Winnie, Texas, and 3 days later, here comes the Narcotics Bureau, the Internal Revenue, and everybody. And I didn't want to make any more money. I thought making money was dangerous, you know. So that's the story behind You Lose a Good Thing. Yes, it was
They
my
couldn't
first...
believe you'd gotten that money legally, huh?
No, everybody thought I was doing something else because we never had no money. You made $75 a week in the barbershop, so... You know, how could you come up with $48,000? I had a check.
Let's talk about what the record industry was like back then and how you got into it. Now, you'd started off in the music business actually playing in a band with your father.
Right.
Why did you want to give that up and end up behind the mixing console producing records?
Well, see, my father and I played because it was a weekend thing where we picked up a little extra money. We played what we call house dances, you know, where people would pass the hat around because we was very poor. And so that we'd do that only on Saturdays, you know. And finally, I got into the radio show on Saturday on KPAC Radio in Port Arthur. And so I got interested in recording, you know, because we did a tape one day and I got interested in recording. So it always interests me. I love music so much, and I like rhythms, you know. I've always been a rhythm and a song man. And to me, if I have the song and a great melody and a great song and a nice rhythm, well, all the background don't mean nothing to me. They called it sweeten up. You know, you sweeten up this and sweeten up that. And it's okay, you know, if it needs it, you know. But I'm the person that likes to do it if you don't need it.
Now, you were working and still are working out of Texas. When you were getting started and you were working in a production studio out of Texas, you had to figure out ways to make your records not only regional hits, but national hits.
Yeah.
What were some of the techniques you would use for getting national attention to some of the regional sounds that you were producing?
Well, I think it's making a hit record like making love to your favorite lover. You know, the feeling is there. It's an emotion, and it's great. It's a great feeling. It has to be there. And if you put that feeling in your records, then everybody in the world's going to feel it.
Yeah, but you still have to get it out on the radio stations
sure,
and get it to a big label
distribute it. I went and put that out in Louisiana and Texas, and the records became so big down there that the big labels from New York and up here would come down there to get it. It was a thing that was fresh. It was grassroots, fresh music. And it was different. It was very hard to get it into New York and make them understand that music, but it worked, you know. It worked. It would be the last outpost to break it at, but it would always work.
What, New York would be the last place to play records?
Yeah, last outpost, because it was so... New York has a problem with they like a copy music, something that sounds like this or sounds like that, something. And a lot of the record companies have a hard time hearing something that is original and that is fresh. And New York is a fast-moving pace city. If you make the wrong decision, you're out. Somebody else got your chair and your job next day. So to make decisions on a completely new sound, it's a very hard job for somebody in New York City, and I understand it, you know.
Did you take your records on the road and play them for DJs to get them played on the air?
Yes, I did. I took them on the road, and I did everything I had to do.
What are some of the things you'd have to do?
When I first met Dick years ago, he played records for me. He's a great man.
This is Dick Clark?
Yes.
So what would you have to do to get airplay on radio stations or on bandstands?
Well, in them days, you did everything. That's before me and Alan Freed days, you know. You just did it. I remember when the first little transistor radios came out, you know, it was a big thing, the small ones. But a friend of mine had a European import in New York. I just went back home with a truckload of them. At Christmas time and all over, I'd come around, well, here's your transistor, give your wife one, give your kid one, everybody. It was a favor for a favor, you know. That's the way our system of government is based on today, you know. And then they invented the old nasty word payola, which is a bunch of bull, you know. I never believed in it because that's the way you elect your people, anybody.
Would you use money as well as gifts?
Money, sure. One guy in New Orleans wouldn't take money from me. I remember taking a $50, $100 bill and throwing it in the trash can and walked out. And I knew he wasn't going to let the guy clean that trash can take that $100 bill out of there. I get in my car and all of a sudden hear my record. And I didn't mind it, because that's the game, that's the game.
I want to play one of the many records that you've produced. And let me reintroduce you first. My guest is Huey Moe, who's one of...
Huey P. Moe.
Huey P. Moe,
name,
okay.
Name after Governor of Louisiana, all right?
Okay. And he was really like the record producer, the independent record producer in Texas, producing a lot of hits, some of which we'll get the chance to hear today on Fresh Air, such as this next record that we're going to hear. And I want to play She's About a Mover, which... You
okay.
produced. You discovered the Sir Douglas
Doug
Quintet.
Sam, right? Mm-hmm.
Doug Sam, right? Now you, this was 1968. No,
65.
I'm sorry, 1965. Mm-hmm. That this was a hit. It was about the time of the British invasion. It was
yes,
in the middle
was.
Of that
big invasion too.
Now, did the British invasion knock your records off the charts?
It knocked everybody's records off the charts. They just took over the country.
And so you had to react to that and figure out a way.
It was a matter of they called eating.
Right. So tell us the story about why you named Doug Sam's group the Sir Douglas Quintet.
Well, I had this idea. I was just trying to figure out the world. I'd figure the world, you know. And I knew that that Doug could play anything. It always bugged me to record. But I knew that I had to have something that sounded a little British, a little different, a little this and that. And it had to be something that came from London, because if it didn't come from London, the disc jockeys wouldn't play it, you know. And I had 8 or 9 records on the charts when the Beatles hit in every form, and just knocked me smooth off the charts, so I had to go out and find me somebody, you know. And I came up with Doug Sam, and his name was Douglas Wayne, and we tried to get some of them that would sound British, so we came up with the Sir Douglas Quintet, you know. And we did a number and come and wrote some songs off of Lake Charles two-step, my daddy's play. Just use that beat and mix a little Chicano rhythm music along with the Cajun music and came off with the song. Doug wrote the song and we recorded She's About a Move and the Rains Came and then went on and told Walt McGuire to leave my name off of it and just put the Tribe record distributed by London Records. And
leave your name off of it so it wouldn't be a
yes,
giveaway that
no,
it was
it
from Texas.
No, it wouldn't be a giveaway, no. And so that it worked. You know, everybody said, oh, wow, here's another record from London. Bow! You know, up the charts it went. And it was fun watching it go.
Let's give it a listen. Okay, you can really hear the regional southern sounds in that. Did it work? Did people really think
sure,
that
fresh,
Sir
know.
Douglas was British?
Yeah, and he picked up an accent. He learned
did
that
he really?
Accent down T and had to tighten up Beatles suits for a while, you know, and all that. And he was good at it. The whole band was.
You know, your sound was nicknamed the bathtub sound.
Bathtub sound, because I never did care about a clinical clean sound. I went more for overtones and feelings, you know, that filled all the speakers in the room, like the mono sound. And guys still mix them today. They'll tell you they're stereo, but they mix them down to mono first and then turn around and add a few little left and rights, you know, and it's still full.
Now, once the Beatles started recording in their, you know, a few albums in when they started using fancy stereo techniques mm-hmm. and recording backwards mm-hmm. and everything. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that to be competitive that you had to get out of the bathtub sound and start making more polished recording studio sounding records?
No,
I didn't.
Mm-hmm. I never believed in trends. I never believed in following anything. I always believed in going by my heart and my feeling and let it rip. You know, if it's got a feeling, it'll make it on its own. If it doesn't, it won't. Just like the Don't Mess With My Toot-Toot, right?
That's
two, three instruments,
hit.
And Boyd played all himself. So how do you answer that?
Now, during your career, you've recorded a lot of black performers and white performers.
Right.
Have there been different ways that you felt you had to break both of those records, different places to take them to, different programs to
sure.
get them on?
Even different mixes.
Really? Different mixes?
Your black mix is a rhythm dance mix. Your bass and bass drum has to be out. Your country or your white rock and roll, is what they call it back then, would be more of the guitar strumming, and the voice would be out a lot further, and the harmonies would be out a lot further. So you started with your mix right away. And you had to I always like to mix both of them together, because a song is a song, and the mood's a mood. If it felt good, it felt good, and it would feel good to anybody. But you had to go. You had to start with your rhythm and blues stations first. If you had an R&B record in them days, nowadays you don't have to, you know, because the black and white kids are together and they like each other's music. But they had a way of separating it back then, you know, and it was terrible. But you had to go that way.
Did you ever fool a radio station or a program into thinking that a white group was black or vice versa?
Many times, and but I didn't know that. See, in my heart, my mother was like me. She was free and unprejudiced from anything, you know. And I just never did like the prejudice feeling among people. I believe it's a hang up with people, you know, regardless if you're black or white or what. But so I cut my records for a feeling. I figured that everybody would like this ice cream. It tasted good, you know. And so sometimes, especially if I run into more trouble up north, coming up north here, when I had a white act that sounded black. Then anyway, because the minute I would put him on the American Bandstand, if he was white, he sounded black, he fell off the black charts the next day.
Oh, because they realized that he wasn't black.
Yeah, right. It's things that that you walk through life, the fields of hatred sometimes, and you meet on the other side. It's pretty when you make it through.
Now, you talked about the black mix being different than the white mix in the recording studio. I want to play a big hit that you had with Archie Bell and the Drells, Tighten Up. Talk about the mix in this.
Well, Archie Bell and the Drells, the Tighten Up was an opening to the show. And but people liked it. He would say, "Hi, y'all, this is Archie Bell and Drell. We're from Houston, Texas, ta-da-da-da." And then he would start his dance like that. And the people would get off to that, and I kept watching them. I said, "Maybe we ought to just record the introduction to the thing and put it out." And it became a hit record, even though we was pushing the other side of it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, called It's a Dog's Eat Dog World. And a friend of mine in Chicago came in drunk at traffic time and put it on the wrong side in Chicago, and all the phones lit up. And so Tighten Up became a hit.
Oh, God, what a great story. Let's hear it. Archie Bell and the Drells, as produced by my guest, Huey P. Moe. And he's known as the Dean of Texas Independent Producers. He launched the careers of the Sir Douglas Quintet, Archie Bell and the Drells, Freddie Fender. We're going to be hearing more of the music he's produced after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Record producer Huey P. Moe is my guest. Now, we just heard a hit that you produced for Archie Bell and the Drells.
Right, mm-hmm.
One of your biggest hits
was
with Freddie Fender, Before the Next Teardrop Falls, which...
In fact, if I could back up just a minute, I got this gold record on Archie Bell and the Drells Tighten Up when I entered the penitentiary in Texarkana. Jerry Greenberg had sent it there, and they presented it to me. There, of course, I couldn't keep it. I'd send it to my office.
Now, let's explain. You were in the federal penitentiary
right,
for
mm-hmm,
a short amount
sure.
of time
mm-hmm.
on charges of violating the Mann Act,
right,
which is
mm-hmm.
taking an underage mm-hmm. woman mm-hmm. across state
mm-hmm.
lines.
Mm-hmm.
So you got this gold record right before you went into prison?
As I went in.
As you went in.
As the policemen were bringing me
oh,
in.
Oh, no, literally.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. So,
so that's what I did. I tightened up.
Were you a big hit in prison? Did everybody know your music?
Oh, yeah, everybody knew. I had some of my friends in there, too. Disc jockeys were in there, too, and different people I knew.
Huh. And when you got out, that's when you hooked up with Freddie Fender, who I think had also been in federal penitentiary for a while.
In fact, that's why Freddie signed up with me. I asked him why he was signed up with him, because I couldn't figure it out, you know. I was still mixed up for about 2 years then. And he said, well, I've been through the same things you have. And he said, I feel like you don't understand me. And that's the way it worked out, you know.
Now, you had him... Did you pick Before the Next Teardrop Falls?
Yes, I did. I picked every hit song you ever had, and he hated every one of them we recorded.
Why did you think that Before the Next Teardrop Falls would be a good song for Freddie Fender?
Well, I don't know. Freddie was going through some changes, and I had lost a sweetheart about that time, and that song matched the mood and the down times I was having at the present times. And so that it was a song that she'd left me for another guy, and the lyrics in it, if he brings you happiness, and I wish you both the best, you know. And so it matched me, and not only did it match Freddie, Freddie was going through the same changes then, and then just happened to be the one that made it for us, you know.
Well, one other thing, this was recorded as a country song.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you had him sing the lyric in Spanish in the middle of the record. Mm-hmm. A kind of maybe risky thing to do for the country charts?
No, I've always been against the grain. I'm independent and hard-headed. I've always been against the grain. I felt like that it was time for Spanish thing to come on up front. I had produced a lot of Spanish hits over my lifetime in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And so that when I talked to Fred, he didn't want to sing it. He said, I can't sing that gringo stuff, man. And I said, well, do it for me, because I wanted him to do it for me, because I wanted to play it for somebody that had left me. See, and so they just fell right in that slot, and bam, it's a home run. And we had a lot of them after that.
Well, this is that record.
If he brings you happiness, then I wish you both the best. It's your happiness that matters most of all. But if he ever breaks your heart, if the teardrop ever starts, I'll be there before the next teardrop falls. Si te quiere de verdad y te da feliz.
That's really a great record. That was a gold record for you.
Yes, probably sold 8 million by now.
You were telling our producer, Amy Sallet,
mm-hmm.
that you finally decided to try to play one of your gold records.
Yes, I did.
Tell me what happened.
In fact, it was this record here, Teardrops, because I've had over 52 gold records, and I always wanted to do that. So when they presented me this for Next Teardrop Fall, I got all wasted one night, and I was sitting in the office. I said, I'm going to try that. Took it out of the frame, and I played the metal part. It was the Supremes record, where I love gold.
Did you feel cheated?
Well, no, it was just funny. I always liked something fresh and something new, you know, and it was something new that I often wondered, you know, was it really my record that made they spread the gold paint on it, you know, but it wasn't. It was somebody else's, which is okay with some good people.
Oh, God, it seems so silly to do that.
Yeah, I know. Nobody but me do that, I believe.
Is there still a regional sound?
Sure.
In Texas, there's still a regional sound?
There's natural sounds everywhere, you know. It's just a matter of people believing in what they're producing. The problem I see with young producers, mm-hmm. they're listening today, I don't have to tell them what to do, is that they need to diversify and teach themselves to produce different types of music. They get hung up in the heavy metal, and nobody likes Bon Jovi and Stryper and everybody better than I do. I love them. I love the song. Per song, not per album, per song that I like to hear them do, you know, just they might go an album I don't like. But I think that the young producers should do as I did over the years and teach themselves to produce the opposite of what they're producing this week, next week, the complete contrast. I think they should teach themselves to produce a little country and shoot a little white rock and roll, I guess you'd call it, the backwoods rock and roll with a southern flavor and the heavy metal. And I think they should go from one to the other and not get stuck in the rut, because what happens, they'll pass them up, their little streak of luck's going to go down, and they're in trouble. You never hear from them again.
Now, right now, you're not really producing records much. How come you've taken a break from actually producing and recording?
Well, I do that. I've done that all my life. I go out and make some money. I go out and make money for about 4 or 5 years and cut a lot of hits. And then I said, the hell with it. I go play. I play for 3 or 4 years, and then whenever money's running a little low again, you know, when I said, and then I get the blues, and then it's time for me to cut another hit record. And it's getting that away now.
One of your many nicknames, I think, is the Crazy Cajun.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
What makes you so crazy? How did you get the nickname Crazy?
I started a radio show in Port Arthur, and I used to get drunk and get up and scream and holler while I spin my music and foot stomping, stop my records in the middle and all that. And people got to writing in the Crazy Cajun. They didn't know my name. A lot of them still don't. And so I kept Crazy Cajun and made a publishing company out of it. I became a very big publishing company. And so the name of Huey P. Moe is a secondary to most people in the business. They know me as a Crazy Cajun.
Mm-hmm. Let's give a listen to the last big hit you had a couple of years ago. This is Rockin' Sidney, My Toot Toot. Now, I want you to tell us how you found him and why you had him, do this.
Good.
Tell us how you found him.
Rockin' Sidney has been around. I recorded him 25 years ago. And the guy that he and I produced him together had a big falling out, and it was ironically that we got back together on producing this. And Rockin' Sidney played all the parts in that. He played all the instruments. He's a great writer. He's not the greatest listener on earth, but he's a great writer and a great person. But that's how we come about. That comes out of Lake Charles, Louisiana. He comes from a little town called La Compte, Louisiana. That's where he's from.
Well, before,
he's a great person.
Before we hear this, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been such a pleasure to have you here.
Well, I'm glad to be here. I want to tell Ed Ward and Austin hello, and he's the one that called me up and told me, and called Amy up, too. I thank you all for inviting me.
We thank you for coming, and thanks for all the listening pleasure you've given us over the years.
I thank you, too.
My guest has been record producer Huey P. Moe, and he's been recording music along the Gulf Coast for decades. Some of the hit records he's produced include Roy Head's Treat Her Right, My Toot Toot, which you're about to hear, by Rockin' Sidney, Tighten Up by Archie Bell and the Drells, and the Sir Douglas Quintet's She's About a Mover. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Rockin' Sidney.
With my toot toot. Now you can have the other woman, but don't mess with my toot toot. When she was born in her bird suit, the doctor slapped her behind. He said, you're gonna be special, you sweet little toot toot. Now you can look as much, but if you much as touch, you're gonna have yourself a case. I'm gonna break your face. Now don't mess with my toot toot. Don't mess with my toot toot. Now you can have the other woman, but don't you mess with my toot toot. Fais pas ça.
On the next Fresh Air, I'll speak with best-selling spy novelist John le Carré. His books include The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and his latest, The Russia House. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Drag strip shocks, piston hard drama, and rock and roll love. That was the ad copy for the film Hot Rod Rumble. Michael Barson reprints the advertising posters from the great teen exploitation films in his book Lost, Lonely, and Vicious. Coming up, we talk about the forgotten B-films of the 50s. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles High Records, the Memphis label that recorded Al Green. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the revamped version of the satirical series Not Necessarily the News. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Dale Willman. A new troop and arms reduction initiative proposed by President Bush was enthusiastically welcomed today by NATO ministers meeting in Brussels. But meetings continue over the divisive issue of short-range nuclear missiles. NPR's Bill Buesenberg has more.
On the plus side, NATO is in general agreement tonight on a new far-reaching arms control proposal that would begin to substantially demilitarize Europe. If implemented, the Bush initiative would cut American troops in Europe by 30,000 and Soviet troops by 10 times as many. The plan would also mean the destruction of hundreds of strike aircraft and tens of thousands of pieces of other military equipment. It is a plan that European officials believe regains the initiative for NATO, something many thought had been lost to the Soviets. On the negative side, NATO is still bogged down in a dispute about negotiating reductions in short-range nuclear weapons. A compromise agreement may emerge tomorrow in time for the final summit communique, but so far there is still no sign such an agreement has been reached. Yet, however serious this NATO split, it has been clearly overshadowed by widespread approval of the deep arms cuts proposed today. I'm Bill Buesenberg in Brussels.
Jewish settlers shot and killed a 16-year-old Palestinian girl and wounded at least two other Arabs today after their car was stoned in a West Bank village. Arab residents of the village say the settlers went on a rampage after the stonings, smashing car windows and setting fire to houses and crops. At least 12 people were reported to have been wounded in that incident. The death of the Palestinian girl brings to 500 the number of Arabs killed during the uprising against Israeli domination of the occupied territories. Police in Cyprus believe they've foiled an assassination plot with the arrests of six men traveling on Lebanese passports. The men with Muslim names said they were planning to assassinate a prominent Lebanese personality. Mike Theodulu has details.
It was designed to be a spectacular assassination. Police said those arrested planned to shoot down with a surface-to-air missile the helicopter of a rival Lebanese leader as he landed at Larnaca Airport. The plot was foiled by accident when two amateur divers discovered two rocket launchers off the Larnaca coast yesterday. Police arrested one man last night and today raided an apartment, arresting four more and finding an arsenal of weapons, including automatic rifles and hand grenades. The police did not say who their target was, but there is speculation that it could even be the Lebanese Christian leader, General Michel Aoun, who is known to use the helicopter shuttle service between Larnaca Airport and the Christian enclave in East Beirut. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
Food riots in Argentina's second largest city have prompted authorities to call a state of emergency. The riots in Rosario followed President Raul Alfonsín's announcement of an emergency economic plan aimed at cutting inflation. More than 200 people were arrested during raids on 30 Rosario supermarkets. Dozens of similar riots were reported from other Argentine cities. A 42-year-old Swede with a long criminal record was charged today with the assassination of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme. Christer Peterson was arrested December 14th. Peterson has denied involvement in Palme's 1986 murder outside a movie theater in Stockholm. Trial is set to begin on June 5th. Poland's government today accused the United States and other Western nations of helping opposition forces prepare for Poland's first democratic elections under communist rule. A statement also charged that some Western diplomats were actively participating in opposition election meetings and that Radio Free Europe is conducting an electoral campaign for Solidarity. Poles vote on Sunday to fill seats in the parliament under an accord with the Solidarity-led opposition. Student protesters hoping to energize their slowing movement with a symbol of democracy wheeled a sculpture inspired by the Statue of Liberty into Beijing's Tiananmen Square today. Firecrackers exploded overhead and 100,000 people cheered as students from the Central Academy of Fine Arts brought the statue, called Goddess of Democracy, into the square. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In the 1970s, soul music fans could count on a bright red label that read Hi, H-I, for great recordings. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward reviews the best of Hi.
When the black popular music industry was born, Memphis was one of its capitals. Its music professionals are working hard to start it back up again, but Memphis, the city that gave rock and roll everything from Sun Records to the Memphis Sound of Stax, is out of the picture these days. True, everybody from ZZ Top to REM goes there to record, but it hasn't had a scene since the mid-70s when Hi Records went under. Hi was the last great Memphis label. It was founded in the late 50s by Joe Quohi, and I'm going to cover more of its history as I get a hold of the music to do it with. But right now, I'd like to concentrate on Hi's end. This may seem odd, but ask any art critic, and you'll find out that in many cases, the most enduring art comes at the end of a civilization's time. Certainly, that was true for Hi. Al Green was Hi's moneymaker, and it's true that he had a voice like no other, as well as a stage presence that melted female hearts at 1,000 paces. But while he paid the bills, there were others.
I can't stand the rain against my window, bringing back sweet memories. Yeah, when the rain, how sweet it used to be.
Peebles projected a dark intensity in songs like I Can't Stand the Rain, Feel Like Breaking Up Somebody's Home, and If This Is Heaven, Send Me to Hell. It wasn't exactly the sort of thing that wound up on the pop charts, but it certainly hit home with plenty of black record buyers who kept her riding the charts. If you heard a similarity between that Ann Peebles record and the sound behind Al Green, it's no coincidence. In its last decade, the aesthetic decisions at Hi were left to Executive Vice President Willie Mitchell, a canny bandleader whose credentials stretch back into the 50s. One singer that Mitchell had worked with off and on for years was Overton Virtus Wright, O.V. Wright, a lapsed gospel singer and drug addict whose ruined voice meshed well with Mitchell's production ideas.
I done got into something
The contrast between Wright's no-stops vocal and the relatively subdued but cooking backup makes I'm Into Something I Can't Shake Loose a deep soul classic. But by 1977, when it was recorded, most of O.V. Wright's best work was behind him, and he had only a couple of years left to live. Syl Johnson came to Memphis from the blues clubs of Chicago's South Side, and Mitchell loved the way his voice worked with the high rhythm section on songs like Back for a Taste of Your Love.
Here I come. Goodbye.
Then there was Otis Clay, about whom I know almost nothing, but who recorded at least one masterpiece.
I used to smoke 5-pack of cigarettes a day. It was the hardest thing to put them away. I drank 4 or 5 bottles of wine. I kept a glass in my hand all the time. Oh, breaking those habits was hard to do.
There were others, the Masqueraders, Quiet Elegance, Joint Venture, and a whole slew of fine instrumentals with that incredible high house band comprised of the three Hodges brothers, Teeny, Leroy, and Charles, and drummer Howard Grimes, who could respond to orders from Mitchell like, "Sit it in the rocking chair for me," and know just what he meant. And then there's this song by songwriter George Jackson that I can't get out of my head since I first heard it the other day.
Me and my baby, we had a big fight, and we ended our romance the same night. In her angry mood, she walked out the door, and he said it's all going to an Aretha Franklin show.
Hi, like so many soul labels, crumbled as disco took over at the end of the 70s. But boy, was it good at the end.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. Blonde Bait, No Time to Be Young, Teenage Caveman, and Juvenile Jungle are some of the forgotten B-films of the 50s. It's hard to see these films now, but you can see the posters that advertise them, reproduced as postcards, in Michael Barson's new book, Lost, Lonely, and Vicious. Barson is a popular culture historian who collects not only movie posters, but also comic books from the 40s, hard-boiled detective pulps, rhythm and blues records, and much more. He told me the kinds of films he wanted to have represented in his new book.
Generally, they're referred to as exploitation films. Many of them are teenage exploitation ones, but all of them combine, I guess you'd say they're all B pictures. They all were not headline pictures when they played, and a lot of them played only in drive-ins.
They all come from the period of 1949 to 1961. I think one of the things about that period is that it's the first time that there was really a teen culture.
Yes, that was just then when you started to see Life magazine running all these alarmist articles about the juvenile delinquency problem in the country. And you had star films like Humphrey Bogart's Knock on Any Door about the same problem. But once it made the headlines, the cheap movie makers rushed into production these kinds of films, and they were made often in 5 or 6 days.
What else was special about the period of 1949 to 61, the period from which you've taken the movie posters?
Well, one of the things that appeals to me about all of these kinds of films is that the element of sex that's in them has to be downplayed and dealt with in a very indirect way, something that seems quaint to us now, 30 years later or more. And it's that approach. You know, it's too late for her to say no, and things like this, which really, it's a treatment that we've lost our innocence long since that day when we could deal with things that way indirectly. Now everything is so direct, and it's lost all of its charm, I think.
I have to say, there's nothing that seems innocent about these movies to me. The movie that you just quoted from, Too Late to Say No, is from Teenage Doll.
Yes.
And the blurb on the poster is, too young to be careful, too tough to care, now it's too late to say no. I mean, that's not not an innocent ad, exactly.
Well,
nor is Hot Rod Rumble with its piston-hard drama.
Well, Terry, I don't know what I can say about the way your mind works. To me, these are very, very innocent.
Oh, they're so insinuating. I mean, isn't that what it's all about?
No, yeah. Of course they are, yes.
It's like super lurid, almost like to compensate for the fact that there was, there was still the code in the movies.
Oh, there was nothing in these movies,
right.
or in the books or in anything else. It was all sizzle and no steak, and it's really appreciating that sizzle that led me to do this.
Let's talk about some of the different types of movies that you include in Lost, Lonely, and Vicious. There's the prison movies and the girl gang movies. As a matter of fact, we have a clip from the movie Reform School Girl.
Gloria Castillo brings you the dramatic, shocking truth about Reform School Girls.
Your name's Donna, huh?
That's right.
What's your rap?
Man got killed. Stolen car, and I wouldn't say who did it.
Ross Hunter, a psychologist who tries to help all Reform School Girls. And Edward Burns, as the kind of a man who is a constant threat to everyone.
I'll figure a way. You better. Man, you better. Or you're fixing to sniff that crazy cyanide.
There's a couple of movies that you have postcards for. There's a Girls in Prison, What Happens to Women Without Men, and Betrayed Women, What Happens Behind the Barrack Walls of the Female Devil's Island. There's always this implicit promise of lesbianism and sadomasochistic sex in the way the ads are written, don't you think?
Oh, yes. And really, I think the whole Girls in Prison thing that is popular with men for that reason. I can't really psychoanalyze the whole culture or even myself, but that's it. However, I saw Girls in Prison, and I can report that there isn't anything like that in the film. So not that they couldn't make a movie with that in it, but it's the innocent period here that I think is funnier.
Let's talk about beatnik movies. We have an excerpt of a trailer here from the film The Beatniks.
These are the beatniks, the defiant young, coming from every walk of life, wrought with suppressed emotions, and mocking the everyday course of modern society, intent on striking back as they wage a battle for their right to be heard.
I love the line that these are the beatniks mocking the everyday course of modern society. That was the big fear that's exploited in these movies, right?
Well, it's that fear that created the headlines for all of these things, you know, kids running wild in the streets and... when you see the Life magazines and the Time magazines' accounts of these things, whether it's beatniks or girls who have to go to reform schools or later the Haight-Ashbury scene in the 60s, it just takes a few years for you to realize, looking back, how ridiculous their account of all that was. But at the time, you know, that's what passes for news.
It must have been great fun to come up with the copy for the posters and for the trailers. Did you ever meet anybody who had the job of writing it?
No, but I want that job. I want to be able to describe Girls on the Loose as trigger tough and ready for anything. I mean, it must have been a blast. Of course, they probably weren't paid anything for thinking up these great lines, but that is really part of the fun with looking at these and enjoying them today.
There were some terrific movies from the 50s that had cameos by rock and roll bands of the time, and some of that footage is really great footage now of people in their prime performing.
Often it's the only good footage we have, you know, although people like Little Richard are still around, many others are not, and that's really the appeal of those. In fact, they're very collectible because many of the great rock stars made their only preserved appearance in some of those movies.
A lot of the movies that you include in Lost, Lonely, and Vicious were B-movies. When they stopped being B-movies, when they stopped basically being double features, did these movies start to die out?
Well, they did, but they're still being made. The difference is that instead of showing up at your local cinema, they're showing up on your home television. You see made-for-TV movies like Katie, Portrait of a Centerfold. These would have been theatrically released movies back in the 40s and 50s, now there's no market for them at $7 a ticket, so they just show up on TV where you watch them for free.
I think one of the projects you're working on now is digging up Red Scare hysteria.
Yes.
Literature.
Yes.
What are you looking for exactly?
Well, everybody knows that there was a period called the McCarthy period in American history where, you know, the whole communist menace thing permeated everything. It had a serious side. But on the other hand, if you can step back a little further and just see how insane the whole thing became, where commies were under every desk in every schoolyard and around every corner, it begins to take on some of the more comic proportions. And I'm gathering together materials like, well, movie posters, of course, from movies like I Was a Communist for the FBI and Red Menace, and my favorite, Zsa Zsa Gabor in The Girl in the Kremlin from 1957. And I'm interested in this because you always see the serious side of it, and there was a serious side to it where, you know, the Hollywood 10 were blackballed and people lost their jobs and so forth. But it's just, again, hard to believe that a nation like ours can just lose its marbles.
Are there any connections to be made between the advertising copy for the teen exploitation movies and the kind of copy that was written during the Red Scare period?
Well, it was the exact same thing, really, Terry, because you probably had the same people making the movies, the same actors acting in them, and the same copywriters writing the copy on the posters. It was just one more headline to exploit. You know, you had John Wayne versus the commies in a movie like Big Jim McLean. You had Mike Hammer, the private eye that Mickey Spillane created, going up against commie gangsters in New York City and in One Lonely Night. And those gangsters supposedly were running around New York with Tommy guns trying to take over the United States. I mean, there is an absurd aspect to it where whatever was really there in the way of some kind of communist menace was just blown so out of proportion that it really is funny today, at least to somebody with my warped sense of humor.
Michael, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Michael Barson's postcard book, Lost, Lonely, and Vicious, is published by Pantheon. Sinister Cinema in Pacifica, California, has released a video of trailers from teen films.
The picture every parent and teenager should see. The story of girls who go too far, too fast. It's the authentic emotional drama of girls in trouble. The gopher-broke generation that tries anything.
This is Fresh Air.
It's Noah Adams, National Public Radio in Washington. On a program this evening, President Bush is at a NATO meeting in Brussels. He proposes to cut back American conventional forces, combat forces in Europe, by a factor of 20%, and a quick reduction is hoped for. And by doing that, in the words of one U.S. official, President Bush is hoping to swamp the missile discussion. That's their words, referring to the fight within NATO over the issue of short-range missiles in West Germany. Also, this question is addressed tonight. Can you or should you try to catch food by trying to chase it down? And a part of a story for Memorial Day, Decoration Day as it was called, in the East Texas hometown of novelist William Humphrey. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
In the late 1950s, The Tonight Show with Jack Parr went from live broadcasts to taped. But now, for the first time, a TV show is heading in the opposite direction, from pre-recorded to live. Television critic David Bianculli reviews the revamped Not Necessarily the News.
Not Necessarily the News, with Annabelle Gurwitch and Tom Parks. Special reports from Meryl Marco, Richard Rosen, and Joe Guppy. Commentary by Will Durst and featuring Lucy Webb. Brought to you tonight by Exxon, where we say there's plenty more where that came from. And by Bounty Jumbo Rolls for those really big spills.
Not Necessarily the News premiered on home box office 7 years ago. And since then, it's poked fun at news and newsmakers by presenting fake commercials, conducting fake interviews, and manipulating real news footage by showing it in a different context. 7 years is a long run for any series. But instead of pulling the plug on Not Necessarily the News, HBO sent it back to the drawing board and came back with a new show with a new cast and one very significant format change.
Good evening. I'm Annabelle Gurwitch, and welcome to the first live Not Necessarily the News.
And I'm Tom Parks, and later on in the show, I'll have a live interview with the Vice President and Mrs. Quayle from Washington. This is a Not Necessarily the News first you won't want to miss.
Going live is a great idea for this show. it allows the writers to be truly topical. In last Wednesday's first live program, they were able to work in jokes on the student rebellion in Beijing, including this one, which has a correspondent defying a martial law press blackout by smuggling his report out of the country in a fortune cookie.
You are greatly admired by those around you. We hope to hear more from John soon.
The show isn't all live, of course. There are plenty of pre-taped segments, from Richard Rosen's report on the overhoused of New York City, people who live in apartments and penthouses much larger than they really need, to Meryl Marco's spoof of the syndicated tabloid series A Current Affair. She calls her version A Current Event and opens with a tongue-in-cheek expose of Current Affair host Maury Povich and his wife, Connie Chung.
She was a beautiful newswoman who rose to prominence as a network anchor. He was a handsome newsman who became known as the host of a syndicated tabloid show. When they met, there were fireworks, and pretty soon they were making headlines of their own. But all their journalistic know-how, all their investigative skills, couldn't save them from that fight at dinner.
As for the Quayle interview Tom Parks promised, it's done Ted Koppel style, with the Quayles on a big screen and supposedly being interviewed by Parks. It's really a cleverly edited piece using someone else's interview with the Quayles, but it looks real enough to be even funnier than it sounds.
How about you, Mrs. Quayle? Do you think your husband could be president of the United States of America?
Oh, definitely.
I have Bobby Knight's basketball books on how to be a good coach and what it takes to have a winning team.
Well, I'm certainly reassured. Mrs. Quayle, how about you?
Oh, I have my own theories.
But you think your husband could stand the pressure?
Under duress, he does a fine job.
By going live, Not Necessarily the News becomes more like the cable equivalent of Dennis Miller's weekend updates on Saturday Night Live. And I'll bet it's no coincidence that HBO waited until the week after Miller delivered his final weekend update of the season to unveil the new live version of Not Necessarily the News. This gives the HBO series a whole summer's worth of Wednesdays to poke fun at the news without worrying whether Saturday Night Live poked it first.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Robert Mason is the author of Chicken Hawk, a critically acclaimed account of his tour of Vietnam as a helicopter pilot. A week after the book's publication, Mason was behind bars in a Florida prison, serving a 5-year sentence on drug smuggling charges. On the next Fresh Air, Robert Mason talks about Chicken Hawk, his time in prison, and his new novel, Weapons. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album by saxophonist George Adams, a former member of the Charles Mingus Quintet. And book critic John Leonard reviews Summer of 49, David Halberstam's account of the year the Yankees won the pennant and were carried to a World Series win by an ailing Joe DiMaggio. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Ed Doherty. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Laura Civitz. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Bergen and Lisa Bruton directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.